Well, turning back to Isaiah chapter 9, so that's page 694, if you're looking at one of the church Bibles. We're going to really focus on verses 6 and 7 today. We looked at the first five verses last week. These are some of the clearest verses in the Old Testament that look forward to the birth of Jesus. They were written about 700 years before he was born. So that's a bit like something being written about your birth, what, back in 1300, just to kind of put that into some perspective. As we've said, they're pretty familiar Christmas verses. They're verses that Handel has famously put to music. My apologies for really scaring the choir last week, who thought that I was going to get them to sing the Messiah this morning. That's not going to happen, I'm afraid. We're not going to do that. But it is beautiful Old Testament poetry. That can be put to beautiful music. But even better, there's some beautiful truth for us to have a look at as we get into the text today. Last week, we thought about the light. And this week, we're thinking about the gift. The gift. What are some of the most memorable gifts that you've received at Christmas? Some of the most memorable gifts, the gifts you look back on. Perhaps it was the gift that you really, really wanted. The kind of gift you started talking to your parents about in July, and you pestered them and you pestered them and you dropped hints and you dragged them into shops and you left the Argos catalogue open at the right page, all of that kind of stuff, where you just couldn't stop talking about it. Dan Goddard's got his head in his hands. He's either experiencing that at the moment or he's remembering a gift like that. Perhaps it was the unexpected gift. Perhaps it was the gift where you had no idea it was coming. When your husband surprised you with a luxury cruise to the Bahamas or something small like that. Yeah, I can see a few of you have had that one. Or maybe it was a strange gift. Maybe it's the one that left you thinking, I'm not quite sure what to say about that. That is usually my brother's gift to me every Christmas. You can ask me about that on the door. Maybe as a child it was the kind of jumper that you got that you thought, I'm never ever going to wear that in public, that dear Aunt Mabel knitted for you when you were about 13. What kind of gifts are memorable for you? Well, Isaiah 9 speaks of a gift that was really wanted, a gift that was unexpected, but also a gift that was slightly strange. Verse 6, for to us a child is born, to us a son is given, a gift. A child is nearly always a blessing, is a gift to parents. But notice this child is not just for one couple. Isaiah says to us, this child is born. For the nation, for humankind, this child is born. The boy is given. He's a gift. The early verses of chapter 9 have been a ray of hope in a world of gloom and a world of darkness. At this stage in the history of God's people, they're at a really low ebb. They're at a really low point. They're under threat. From outside, there is a threat of the superpower of Assyria, who are poised ominously, ready to attack them. From inside, the nation has been turning away from God. But God here promises through Isaiah that there is going to be a turnaround, that there is going to be honour instead of humiliation, there's going to be light instead of darkness, and there's going to be joy instead of mourning, verse 3. And we began to see last week that there are three reasons for why that takes place. Verses 4 to 6 give us three big reasons for why this joyful celebration takes place. Each of verses 4 to 6 begins with the word for, because. For some reason, the NIV drops it in the NIV, but if you're looking at an ESV today, you'll see it there. Three reasons for why they can rejoice. Three reasons for hope. Firstly, because verse 4, oppression is lifted. Secondly, verse 4, because war is over. And then the ultimate reason, which we get in verse 6, because a child is born, the child who comes with a purpose. And notice the purpose is given there in verse 6. He's been given to carry the weight of government. The government will be on his shoulders. It's been quite a year for leaders, hasn't it? Been quite a year. A new American president that I guess if we go back 3 years ago, nobody would have expected that he would become president. It's like thinking Alan Sugar will become the next prime minister. I'll leave you to ponder that prospect. We've had a new prime minister this year. Theresa May has replaced David Cameron. Again, unexpected. Jeremy Corbyn has stayed as leader of the Labour Party, but only after another vote. UKIP, well, I've lost count of how many leaders UKIP have had over the past year. The Italian Prime Minister resigned this week. Fidel Castro died recently. The England football team have changed their manager twice, even in the past couple of months. It's been all change on the leadership front. And Isaiah is writing at a similar time of leadership instability. The long reign of King Uzziah had come to an end. Uzziah had reigned for over 50 years. And he died in the year that Isaiah was first called to be a prophet. Uzziah was largely a positive ruler. He'd given stability, but after that we've had instability. Jotham, his son, had a much shorter reign, just 16 years. And now the king is Ahaz, as we get to Isaiah 9. And Ahaz didn't live the way that a king should. Got so bad that 2 Kings 16 says that Ahaz even burned his son in the fire following the Canaanites. So we've got a leadership void here. Leaders that can't be counted on, good leaders who come and go. But Isaiah says there's one coming to be king. And he will shoulder the responsibility. He'll carry the weight on his shoulders and he'll be able to take it. He won't crumble under that pressure. Isaiah's uncertain times needed a king who could be relied on. And our uncertain times need a reliable leader that we can look to. And God said through Isaiah, I'm going to give you a king just like that. Not to just hold it all together, but a king to fix everything that's broken. Not just to be the best king you've ever had, but to be the only king you ever need. And his name, of course, was Jesus. That's why Christmas. That's why we celebrate. That's why, because this king has come. Well, let's dig a bit further into the text. We're going to ask two questions. What is the king like? And think about his names. And what is the king's rule like? And think about what he does. So firstly, what is the king like? His names. Have you ever had a nickname, a name that stuck for you? In my first year of secondary school, I got the nickname Tiny Tot, which was after a small jelly baby type sweet that you could buy. Not because I was sweet, which I was, of course, but because I was short, which was fine. I don't think I've got a long-term complex as a result of that, especially now I'm quite so tall as I am. But There was another lad in my year at school, and he had a nickname, and everybody knew his nickname, and he was called Killer. Now, if there's a kid in your school and he's known as Killer, you'd steer clear of that boy, wouldn't you? You don't mess with a guy called Killer. Except, actually, he was the weediest, least offensive boy you could possibly ever meet. Killer, or Nicholas Trevunic, to give him his real name, couldn't hurt a fly. It was a name that was just packed with irony. You know, the names of this child are not here to tease, they're not ironic. They're not even names just to intimidate. Boxers have those kind of names, don't they? Names to intimidate. In the first Rocky film, Rocky comes up against the world champion, Apollo Creed, and when Apollo Creed is introduced to the crowd, he's introduced with a long list of nicknames. He's the Dancing Destroyer, he's the King of Sting, my personal favourite, he's the Count of Monte Fisto, he's the Prince of Punch, he's the Master of Disaster, he's the one and only, he's Apollo Creed. You know, Rocky's beaten, it seems, before he's even started with a list of names like that. The names Isaiah mentions here of this child, they're not ironic. They're not to intimidate, but they're to comfort God's people. These are really comforting, strong names for us. You know, it feels like after every name we should cheer. He's called Wonderful Counselor. Yes. He's called Mighty God. Fantastic. These are great names. So let's see what they mean. First, he's called Wonderful Counselor. Wonderful is connected to a root word that describes things that only God can do. Wonderful describes things that are beyond human capability. They have a divine quality. If you look at the word wonderful in the Old Testament, you'll find it's attached to God's deeds, his acts. They are wonderful. And this king will be a counselor, one who gives wisdom. Ahaz, the current king, is a king who thought he was clever, who thought he was politically savvy, but he wasn't wise. This promised king is going to have divine wisdom. He's going to have supernatural counsel. We know, don't we, that leaders normally have to surround themselves with lots of advisors, lots of wise counselors. But this king is the wisest in the room every time. This is like having Solomon, the wise king, back again. And yet even more, he is wonderful counselor. He is full of wisdom. And of course, when Jesus arrives, that is just what he's like, isn't he? When he is sat as a 12-year-old boy in the temple with his teachers, they are amazed at his understanding. Don't you long for somebody today with all the answers? Someone you can turn to who's got all the answers. Wouldn't it be great to have somebody to go to who knows exactly what to say in every situation, in every circumstance, who always just gives you the best advice and the wisest counsel? I sit with people sometimes and they're going through something and I don't have a clue what to say. I don't know what is helpful and what isn't. Sometimes there is nothing to say in tragedy or heartbreak. Sometimes silence is the best thing. But what about a king who is completely wise? What about the one who always takes the right option in even the most difficult of circumstances? And what about someone who's got wisdom about your situation and what you're experiencing? Someone to turn to. Someone who will lead you with infallible wisdom. Who'll never mess you up. You talk to me, I'm going to mess you up sometimes with what I say. You'll do that for others when they speak with you. You'll mess them up. But Jesus never will. He never does. He won't ever mess you up. He won't tell you everything you want to know. But he's spoken with wisdom. Spoken with wisdom. What he says is absolutely right. He's a wonderful counsellor. But he's also called Mighty God. Second name, Mighty God. And I guess this is where for Isaiah's readers, and probably for Isaiah himself, the picture gets a bit blurry because it's hard to put this together. The language you see is about a boy being born, isn't it? And verse 7, we read that he's going to reign on David's throne. So it's a new king who's going to be born in the line of David, one of David's descendants. They were waiting for that. 2 Samuel 7 had promised a king in David's line who was going to reign forever. So we're waiting for a human king, and yet he's called Mighty God. Chapter 7, a couple of chapters earlier, he's also called Emmanuel, God with us. So how can he be both Mighty God and human Davidic king? And Isaiah and the other prophets, they couldn't put those threads together. They didn't know how they reconciled, but of course in Jesus they are. Fully God and fully man, 100% God, 100% man. He was Mighty God, wasn't he? And he was Mighty God. He walked on water, didn't he? Not like a kind of Dynamo the Magician trick where he walks across the Thames, but to show that he had power over the water. And he calms the storm to show he's got power over the air. And he provides food on a hillside and wine at a wedding to show his power over the earth. He's Mighty God. You see, that's what the Bible says about Jesus. He was Mighty God. You can't leave this morning with a sort of sense, well, I admire Jesus. I like a few things about him. You can't say, I'm a bit of a fan of some of the things he's about, but I'm not going to change my life because of him. Whenever people met Jesus, they didn't have that reaction. When people met Jesus in the New Testament, they either hated him, or they thought he was ridiculous, dangerously deluded, or they worshipped. One of those three responses. Hated, thought he was deluded, or they worshipped. Admiring him or respecting him or having a bit of time for him, that wasn't an option. Reject or worship, those are your options today. This morning you're either a worshipper or a rejecter of Christ. He's either Lord, he's either everything, or he's just nothing. The third name, let's move on to that one, Everlasting Father, Everlasting Father. Now, to be clear here with this word, this is not saying that Jesus the Son and God the Father are really one person. That's not what the text is saying. This isn't kind of blurring the lines of the Trinity. Now, this is saying that he is like a father to us. He cares for us like a father does. Father was a title that was used in the Old Testament and it was used of the Lord to express his care for the weak and his support for his people. And that's what the king's going to do. He's going to follow the divine pattern. He's going to care. In his rule, he's not going to exploit people, but he's going to govern for them. And everlasting is not so much focused on his eternal nature, but it's focused on the fact that as a father, he's not going to end. He's a father who's not going anywhere. It's focused on the fact that he will not stop being a father. He's not suddenly going to bail out. He's not going to lose interest. He's not going to be the kind of father who walks out after a period of time. Everlasting Father. Isn't it remarkable that when Jesus comes, he comes to serve, not to be served? But that is astonishing, isn't it? He comes to be a champion for the most unlikely of people, for sinners. Who does he hang out with? He hangs out with tax collectors. He ministers to women who've been caught in adultery. He's the defender of the weak. He comforts those in need. That's who he comes for. Are you feeling weak? Are you feeling at the end of yourself? Do you feel a bit battered this week? Elderly relatives worrying you, stressed at work, thinking God is not really anywhere to be seen. Seems like that at times, doesn't it? Seems like he doesn't care. Seems like he makes life harder going than it needs to be. Friends, he hasn't stopped loving you this morning. He hasn't left you. Remember, Jesus walked this road too. He's been rejected too. He's been exhausted at the end of a day too. He's shouldered burdens too. He's sacrificed for others too. Dorothy Sayers, a writer, said, "He can extract nothing from man he's not extracted from himself. He himself has gone through the whole of human experience." That's the kind of king we have. Friends, he's not going anywhere. He's not walking out on you. Perhaps your earthly father did that. But he's not doing that. He's not going to discover something about you that makes him change his mind. Because he knows everything about you already. You never surprise him. Feeling weak today, feeling fragile, perhaps not quite sure if God's got hold of you. Just take a few moments at the cross today. Go back to the cross today. See him loving you to death there. That's how he fights for you. That's how he cares for you. Everlasting Father. And then a fourth name, Prince of Peace. Last week we saw in verse 5 that there is no more war. The coming of the Son brings no more war. But sometimes the end of war is not that much better than the war itself, is it? The end of war can leave things devastated. A devastated land, buildings wrecked and destroyed, the economy in a mess. There are families who are mourning. There are those who don't come back. But in biblical language, peace, shalom, is not just the absence of conflict, but it's everything back as it should be. It is wholeness, it's completeness, it's everything right, everything in place. And this king will be the Prince of Peace. That'll be the characteristic of his rule. That's what it'll be like. He owns it. He makes peace. I guess it's one of the things we'd all be glad for at Christmas, wouldn't we? You know, even if the turkey gets a bit overdone, even if the crackers don't go bang, you settle for peace, wouldn't you? Peace would be great. You know, Jesus isn't like the some impressive UN mediator who comes to do great counselling in that sort of setting, or the best marriage guidance counsellor you could possibly wish for. He doesn't just bring peace between us. He brings peace between us and God. That's the peace he makes. Not by being a mediator just with great negotiation skills, but by offering his life. Standing between us and God, representing us to God as he takes our sin, and representing God to us as he gives us his righteousness. You see, there's no papering over the cracks with this peace. This is not a temporary ceasefire. This is peace, firm and certain, bought at the price of his life. This is what the king's like. He's wise. He's mighty. He's caring. He's sacrificial. And that's what Jesus is for you today. If he's your king, that is your king. That's who he is for you. Well, what is the king's rule like? Let's move on into verse 7. What's the rule like? And a few things to see about his rule. Firstly, it will never stop. It will never stop. Of the greatness of his government and peace, there will be no end. When you have a leader who is really, really good, you want them to go on forever, don't you? One commentator has said about this text, total security requires not just a stop-go rule, but is achieved in a king who reigns forever. And that is Jesus. He won't stop reigning. His death wasn't the end. Even the resurrection was not the last stage in the journey, because now he's ascended and he's in charge and he's reigning in heaven. And there is ultimate security in that. Ultimate security. There's vulnerability, isn't there, whenever there is a change. Why did Alex Ferguson stay on and on and on as manager at Manchester United? There were various moments in his time there where it looked as if he was about to retire. It looked as if he was about to stop. But he was at the centre of their success. He was the critical component as a manager of the team. The owners wanted him there as long as possible. And now he's gone? Well, Manchester United are struggling to get back to where they were. They're not the force they were. If a leader is great, we want them to go on. And that's what King Jesus will do. There is no prospect of an abdication. There's not going to be a day when we come to church one morning and I have to give you the news, well, Jesus is not so well. He's just had to step down for a little bit. That day is not coming. I don't know what it is that makes you feel secure when, as we live in this kind of uncertain age, where the security comes from votes that go the way we want them to, or if we haven't heard about a terrorist attack too close to us recently, or we haven't seen a crash in the market in recent months. But those things will all tend to happen, won't they? They'll all happen from time to time. But the unexpected never happens in heaven. There's never something that goes awry that Jesus hasn't anticipated or known or been in control of. You see, there's real security here because his reign will never come to an end. One day we're going to get the news, aren't we, that Elizabeth II has died. If we've not died first, we'll one day get that news ourselves. That day will come. And it'll be one of those days, I think, when the texture of our country just changes. Not day to day, but that's a person who's been there, I guess, for everybody in this room throughout our lifetime. But Jesus is not going to. Kings and queens will come and go. Presidents and prime ministers will come and go. Strictly Come Dancing judges will come and go. Wives, husbands and parents. Eventually, either we will leave them or they will leave us. But Jesus doesn't. Security comes from knowing he is always, always there. He'll never stop reigning. And then his rule will never corrupt. His rule will never corrupt. How does he establish his throne? He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with what? Justice and righteousness. It is an empire that Jesus is building. Absolutely. The increase of his government and peace, there will be no end, but it's a rule without any exploitation. The moral foundation is absolutely solid in Jesus' rule. Justice means that the right procedures are followed. When things are done against the law, justice is given. Justice is meted out. Righteousness means the right laws are made. The right principles are made. The law's a good thing. And we need both of those things, don't we? We need our leadership to establish good laws and then keep to them, establish them fairly, administer them fairly. We want a leader, don't we, who embodies both of those things, who doesn't just have one rule for us and then one for them. And justice and righteousness are just the characteristics of his reign. That's who Jesus is. That's what he's like. And that's what his rule is like. He can be absolutely trusted. Absolutely trusted. Maybe you're here this morning and for you, trust is actually a really difficult thing. Maybe you've been betrayed in the past. Maybe you've been lied to. maybe by somebody who was close to you, somebody you looked up to. And now, if you're honest, you find it really difficult to trust anybody at all. You wonder if everybody you meet has got something they're hiding. You know, Jesus was never, ever found out. Those he lived with, close up for 3 years, said he did no sin, and in him was no sin. That's what they said. They saw him under pressure, under stress, and that's what they said. He lived with such a transparent integrity that even people where sin was there for all to see, even they were drawn to him. Such integrity, such purity, such transparency. He lived in a sinful world and he didn't give in to that at all. And now living in a perfect heaven, he maintains integrity. Guys, churches can go wrong. Christian leaders can go wrong. I've been reading sadly this week about a church leader that I'm familiar with who has gone wrong badly. But Jesus never will. He never will. You want someone you can trust? You feel let down by those who made you promises and walked away, and maybe a friend who said, I just don't really want to know you anymore. Guys, you can trust him. You can trust him with everything you have. And then this kingdom will not run out of steam. It will not run out of steam. Notice he will establish and uphold this kingdom with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. Most of us get to the point of wanting to retire, don't we, from the job that we've done. Perhaps for you, that was about 18 months into your first job. You were ready to retire and just give it up. Some of you have worked a long time. I can just see it as I look around. The scars are there. And you're ready to retire. You're ready to be finished. Although, did you see the story of Joe Bartley this week, the 89-year-old who was bored? So he offered himself, advertised his services, and this week he got himself a job in a cafe in Paignton in Devon. You know, even Joe one day is going to run out of steam. Even Joe is going to have to finally retire. We all do. We can't keep up the pace. We get older. We run out of ideas. But this king doesn't. This king doesn't run out of ideas. Jesus doesn't. He's not putting together his 2017 strategic plan. Everything is in place. He knows what he's doing. He's gradually seeing the increase of his greatness and peace. One day to cover the world. He owns it all now, but one day everything will be seen to belong to him and will bow the knee to him. Guys, he's not weary. He's not losing heart with being a king. He's not going to run out of resources. He's not going to run out of ideas. He's not going to say enough's enough. If you're joined to Christ, you're joined to the one project in history that's never going to finish and never going to cease and never going to fail. The one business that's never going to go bust. The last thing to see about this kingdom, the fourth thing is, it doesn't depend on us. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. Verse 7. Every kingdom on earth can be toppled, can't it? Every kingdom comes to an end. The Assyrian Empire, it came and went. The Persian Empire came and went. The Roman Empire came and went, and on and on. We've just got the relics now. That's all we've got. Every superpower the world has ever known comes and goes. They can all be overthrown. They'll all be toppled. There's no certainty. But it's God who establishes it. It's God who puts this throne in place. It's his zeal. It's his passion to make it happen. He will make sure it does. He has done that. And I want to just say, maybe this is actually our sticking point today. That it's God who's going to do this. Because we would love a world where there is peace and justice and righteousness. Where we're cared for, where there's security. But we also sometimes, don't we, want a world where God just doesn't interfere. And God lets us get on with life. Where we do it ourselves. Where we fix it. Where we don't really need any help. Where we stay king. Where we stay in charge. See, the problem with a Christmas gift, the problem with a child is that it's a pretty tough gift to accept, if we're honest. And it's a hard gift to accept because we've got to humble ourselves. Tim Keller has written a Christmas book for this year called Hidden Christmas. And he talks in there about gifts that are, by nature, pretty hard to accept because they make us swallow our pride. He says, Imagine Christmas morning and you get up and you've got a present from a friend and you open it all up and you're all excited and you find out it's a dieting book. And then you pick up the next present and you open that from another friend and you open it up and the title of the book is Overcoming Selfishness. If you say, well, thanks very much, these are just what I was hoping for, just what I need, you're having to admit, aren't you, that you're obese and obnoxious. You've got to humble yourself to accept those kind of gifts. Keller says this, there's never been a gift offered that makes you swallow your pride to the depths like the gift of Jesus Christ. To accept this king, to take hold of this gift, to benefit from Jesus, the king ruling over us, then we have got to humble ourselves to accept we're not the king. That as much as we might want peace and security and wisdom and somebody will fight for us and care for us, most of us would rather stay in charge. Most of us would at least rather maintain a little pocket of control. We'd rather leave the gift and keep trying to make it on our own. Let me be as simple as I can. As we come to a close, you can't do life without God's help. You just can't. You certainly can't face death without God's help. You can't get into heaven without God's help. You can't make up for your sin. You can't have your sin forgiven without God's help. You're a fool if you think you can. But if you know you can't, if you know you must have God's help, that you need God's king, then let's worship the king. Let's follow the king. Let's honour the king and go all